Welcome to the Casey Kowar Show, a celebration of words. I'm delighted to have back for the third time Ian Rankin, and we'll be discussing Mr. Rankin's new novel, The Naming of the Dead, published by Little Brown. So for all the fans that have been saying, when is Inspector Rebus coming back, the answer is now. So first of all, Ian, thanks so much for taking time out of a busy schedule to talk with us.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Ian, with The Naming of the Dead, we get the new Rebus, and I read the novel. I loved it. And tell us a little bit about it. It's set during a very, one of the things I like about the Rebus series, and you and I have talked about, is that Rebus ages and goes through life. You've never stopped and started him. And so the natural progression of the series has led to this story takes place over in Scotland during the G8 summit. And as you're writing it, did it pose any difficulties for you to not make too much of a political statement and to have Rebus function during this conference? Did you feel any, did that cause any particular difficulties?
No, I don't think so. The only thing I had to be careful about was, you know, you're right, it takes place during a particular week that really happened, the G8 meeting of world leaders in Scotland, July 2005. It was an extraordinary week in the life of the country. There were hundreds of thousands of protesters and demonstrators. There were tens of thousands of cops suddenly arrived in Scotland. And what I needed to do was to have a little bit of balance. And I knew in my heart that Rebus, being a cynical old cop in his late 50s, would think that none of this is going to change the world. You know, that hundreds of thousands of people marching through the streets ain't going to change a thing. Pop concerts put on by rock stars aren't going to change anybody's minds. So I needed to balance that. And luckily I've got Siobhan, his colleague, who's much younger than him and is more idealistic. So I was able to put the two points of view forward without taking one side or the other.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes, and Siobhan, as we've talked, her character, she basically gets co-billing again in The Naming of the Dead. She's become an important part of the series. And the novel opens with Rebus's the death of Rebus's brother. And I think in The Naming of the Dead, I think we see some sides of Inspector Rebus and Shobhan Clark that because her parents end up coming and attending, and we won't give anything away, but they play they play a part in the novel as well. And I think we find out a little bit more about Rebus in this book than we have in some of the others.
Yeah, I mean, the book at its core is about personal responsibility. It's about, you know, whether or not we can make a change to the world. And Rebus is coming towards the end of his police career, and he's starting to have these big questions. Have I made a difference? You know, the job that I've been doing these past, you know, 20 books or whatever, and the 20 years that we've known him, you know, putting away all these bad guys, putting them in jail, seeing justice is done, has that actually changed the world one iota for the better? Because sometimes it seems that every time he puts a bad guy in jail, there's another 10 spring up to take their places. So, you know, it's also a novel about aging, which is why I started it with a scene at a funeral. His brother has died. His brother is slightly younger than John Rebus. And so he's got thoughts of mortality on his mind, thoughts of retirement and thoughts of mortality, which might make it sound like a pretty downbeat book. But in fact, it was a hell of a lot of fun to write. There was so much exciting stuff happening in and around Edinburgh that whole week. And hopefully there's a few good jokes squeezed in there as well.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and one of the things I like is, you know, Rebus is kind of thinking to himself, hey, the Stones are still touring, Daltrey's still touring, why do I have to retire?
Yeah, I mean, when the book opens with some music from The Who and with Rebus thinking about his impending retirement, because in Scotland, in real life, in the cops, if you're a detective, you've got to retire at 60, you're made to retire at 60. Rebus isn't going voluntarily. He wouldn't go gentle into that good night, as the poets have it. He's being forced out of the game. But he thinks to himself that Daltrey and Townsend and Jagger and Richards are all older than him, still touring, still rocking, still making music. And the book actually opens with the music from a Who album. album Quadrophenia, and the reason I did that is because I discovered that Pete Townsend, the lead songwriter and guitarist with The Who, is a fan of the books. He sent me an email last year to say how much he enjoyed Flesh Market Alley, and so just as a little nod to him and a little thank you, I'm going to put him right at the start of the next book. So I'm waiting for another email from him to say that he was pleasantly surprised.
Plus, I mean, really, Quadrophenia, I remember when it came out, it really did change music. I mean, you could get the speakers set up just right and do the proper number of bongs, and you were just in a different world than you'd ever been before.
Yeah, that just about sums it up. It's a great album.
It is a great album.
I just thought it was right for that, kind of for the tone of the funeral, that, you know, Rebus's brother would want rock music played at his funeral.
Absolutely. And Ian, an important part of the novel involves a character, Ben Webster. And what happens is every government's worst nightmare is that some murders take place during a period of time where the country is trying to put on its best face for the rest of the world. And one of the things I enjoyed is that You really showed us, those of us that aren't from Edinburgh, what it was like to be a citizen trying to drive around, or if you were a painter trying to get your work done during this period of time. But there's also some very serious crimes being committed during the days of the novel.
Yeah, I mean the idea for the book started a few months before the G8. Suddenly, in the press and the media, there was all these stories and rumors that, you know, there were going to be all these demonstrations and riots and calamities, and there'd be this huge police presence. And I thought two things. One, I thought that's a really interesting backdrop for an everyday cop who's trying to solve a crime. How does he manage to go about his business when all this stuff is happening on the surface? Another thing I thought was, I can think of one cop who wouldn't be welcome at the party. You know, because sure. Rebus's bosses would not want him getting anywhere near the leaders of the free world.
No.
So all this activity that's going on, and he's not part of it. He's not allowed to be part of it. So there was those two things that made me think this would make a really good backdrop to a novel. But then when I start to think about what the actual plot might be, and, you know, when the theme came to my mind that it should be about what difference do we make in the world, then I got my character of my Member of Parliament and his fall from the castle ramparts, or was he pushed? And, you know, looking at ideals and looking at political ideals and whether, you know, whether the political process allows for people with ideals to retain those ideals. So, there's quite a big question at the centre of it that I hope readers will ask themselves. But if they don't, they're still going to get a good, good roller coaster read.
Absolutely. And part of the center of the plot involves a website called Beast Watch, and we won't get into too much of the details. But you also mentioned Pete Townsend a little bit ago, and you know, this the thing with the internet gets really kind of dicey whenever, you know, the internet overall is a very wonderful thing, but in the wrong hands it can become a very dangerous thing. And I thought you dealt with that brilliantly in The Naming of the Dead, of how we have to be careful in a free society to protect everyone, all of our citizens. And you really do some really creative things with how this all ties together, using, you know, trying what starts out, their intentions are good, and then they go astray.
Yeah, I mean, it's an extension of something I did in a previous book. There was a real-life case in Scotland of a suspected paedophile who was basically, you know, run out of town. And, you know, that's the rumor mill starts you're back to the basic idea of the crucible, I guess. Mm-hmm. Play the crucible, that you can get a witch hunt going just using rumor. Well, of course, the internet makes that a lot easier and a lot faster. That you've got to be very careful that the stuff you take on board from the internet, that you actually are able to validate it, and it isn't just rumor and conjecture. I find that, you know, my son's 15, and he uses the internet a lot for research for school projects and stuff. And I say to him, I say, yeah, but make sure you double check, because what you're getting there is just one person's opinion.
That's right.
It's not like picking up the Oxford English Dictionary or something.
Yeah, that's
right. You're
getting
one person's opinion. You really need to get validation of that. And, you know, I mean, we, Yeah, I mean, it's a very, I mean, it's an interesting tool. The thing about all these new technologies is that the police love certain aspects of them. They, I mean, they, you know, they like certain aspects of all this new technology, but they don't like it when it's used against them.
Sure, sure. And the title of the novel, The Naming of the Dead, published by Little Brown, is this is a ritual that are they still doing it, Ian, over in Edinburgh? The
no, this was a one-off. This was again something that I read about in the newspaper on the Sunday of the G8 week.
Okay.
There was a march through the streets of Edinburgh, and the protesters were protesting against the war in Iraq. At the end of the march, they went up what's called Calton Hill, which is an extinct volcano at the eastern end of the main street in the city, and they read out the names of 1,000 people who had died on all sides of the conflict in the war in Iraq. And in the newspaper it said, this is the naming of the dead ceremony. And I thought, wow, what a great title for a book.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It just happened that once on that one day, but it just gave me that, you know, it was, you know, this word serendipity, which means everything kind of falls into your lap, everything clicks, everything suddenly, you know, happens for the best. That whole week there was just stuff happening that I had to write about, and that made for great scenes in the book and great backdrops. And the title of the book was yet another gift. Gifted to me.
Yeah.
I didn't have to do any work at all. You know, I mean, the hardest work I did that whole week was just wandering around the city, just getting an atmosphere, just picking up the atmosphere.
Mm-hmm. And Big Jer Cafferty plays an important role in the novel, and I'm just going to read just one brief excerpt, because I just think it captures so much of the essence of where Rebus and Big Jer are. It says, it struck Rebus that what Cafferty feared was a loss of power. Tyrants and politicians alike feared the self-same thing, whether they belonged to the underworld or the overworld. The day would come when no one listened to them anymore, their orders ignored, reputation diminished. And boy, isn't that what so many people fear when you start to get to that age where you realize no one's going to pay any attention to what you're saying anymore?
Absolutely, and I mean, we see it time and time again with tyrants the world over, whether it's gangsters who run and ruin a community, or whether it's tyrants who run and ruin a country. You know, I mean, the one thing that catches up with them is age.
Yes.
The aging process does for them every time, and eventually there'll be someone younger, fitter, hungrier, and more venal who will come along and want their crown.
Yes.
And so Cafferty's feeling it as well. I mean, he's much the same age as Rebus. They are still two sides of the same coin. They are Cain and Abel, or Jekyll and Hyde, you know, they're both looking at a kind of retirement, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And what Rebus is terrified of is that this gangster who basically runs Edinburgh will still be around after Rebus has been forced into retirement, and he will get his claws into Siobhan, the next generation. And so Rebus is desperate for that not to happen, and that is something that is tackled in the next book in the series.
Good. Yeah, because Siobhan is, she is her own woman, and she is highly influenced by Rebus. And I think one of the things I'd like to get an update on from you on is, as we've talked, Siobhan right when we first started talking, you're working on the next novel. Siobhan is she going to continue on, Ian, as the primary character in the novels that you're writing?
I don't know.
Don't know yet.
You know, I've thought about it, but I've not come to any serious conclusion yet. I mean, at the moment, I'm focused on the next book, which is the book in which Rebus will have to retire because he will reach the age of 60. I'm concentrating on that. What happens after that book is published, I'm not sure, because I've got other projects on the go, and I've got to get those projects done before I can start thinking about a possible next Rebus novel, or whether to do a Siobhan book with her as the main police character and have a civilian helping out or hindering her, doing the dirty work for her so she can out of the angels. There's a lot of different things that I could do, but right now I'm focusing on the book, not what comes after.
Good. There's a wonderful scene in The Naming of the Dead where Rebus is on page 278, where he has a moment where he's staring at the liquor bottle. And I thought it was some brilliant writing, because it in three or four paragraphs, you really show us a lot about the heart and soul of Rebus, and he really does a lot of reflection on the role that that his lifestyle has played in his career. And I just thought that was just a brilliant scene, and I thought it was very cinematic when I read it.
Well, it's funny you should say that, because the Rebus books are being filmed for television. I mean, they've already filmed 7 or 8 of them, and I think 3 or 4 have been shown on public broadcasting in the States, on BBC America. And they've signed up. I didn't think they would sign up Naming of the Dead because of the whole GA thing, and you know, it would be very expensive to film, you know, to suddenly have to stage a demonstration. So I didn't think they would take it on, but they have taken it on, and I think it's because they did find a cinematic quality in some of the writing.
Mm-hmm. Good.
Whether that scene makes it in, though, is a moot point, because
yeah.
TV usually extracts 5% of the material and makes up the rest.
Right, exactly. And then you have a reference to Steely Dan, which I just have to throw in because it's one of my favorite bands of all time. And I was delighted to see a reference to, and even an obscure Steely Dan recording. So I was that made me very happy.
Yeah, well, I'm a big Steely Dan fan as well.
Yeah, I am.
I'm not
too.
Sure whether Rebus is. I guess he likes them.
Yeah.
Maybe not quite gritty enough for his taste.
Yeah.
Like a kind of harder blues sound.
Yeah. And the epilogue of the Naming of the Dead, again, it was just beautiful, and it was just so satisfying. And I would have to.
That wasn't there in the original version of the book, though.
Oh, really?
The book actually ended with the piece before the epilogue, and I handed it into my editor in the UK in London. And he said, you know, I like this sort of very open ending, but it's a bit pessimistic, and I don't think Rebus would give up. So then I went away and thought about what Rebus might do, and that was the epilogue. So that was written afterwards.
Oh, really?
At the request of my editor.
Okay. Well, I thought it. I'm glad that your editor persevered. Yeah, because it really is just. I read it a couple times, and it really just there's a very existential feel to it, and it's very, very nice, and I really enjoyed it. Ian, tell us a little bit about the serialization you're doing for the New York Times Magazine.
Yeah, I was thrilled and honored to get an email from the New York Times saying, you know, you may not know this because we know you don't live in the States, but we run this these novellas serialized in the Sunday Magazine. We would like you to do one for us. And, you know, they said we've had the writers in the past have included Patricia Cornwell and Michael Chabon and Michael Connolly. I think Elmore Leonard did one as well. And I was going to be the first non-American that they'd asked to do it. So, I mean, I was absolutely thrilled and honored. And immediately thought, what a challenge, because they're looking for, you know, around 35,000 words, which and they're looking for 2,500 words per chapter, and you can't go either side of that line. It's got to be around about 2,500. You've got little twists so that readers are going to want to come back the next week, and the plot can't be too complex, otherwise readers will have forgotten what happened the previous week and won't be able to catch up. So, I mean, it really was a challenge, but I love doing it. The story almost wrote itself, and it's set in Edinburgh, it's set in Scotland, it's a heist. I love heist thrillers.
Mm-hmm.
You don't see enough of them these days, I don't think. So it's not Rebus, there is a cop in it, but it's more from the villain's point of view. But it's much lighter in tone than the Rebus books. It's a little nod towards Ocean's 11. There's a touch of Ocean's 11 in there.
Okay.
Set in Edinburgh.
Okay.
So it was a lot of fun, and the Times will start publishing it, I think, the third Sunday in May, and it'll run for 15 weeks.
Great. Well, I'll post on the site when we get a definite date on that. I'll make sure everybody's aware of that.
Yeah, great. Thanks.
Yeah, I'm interviewing Michael Connolly on Monday, and he took the Overlook, which
yep.
was what he did, and then expanded it into a novel.
That's right.
And
he's added about 15,000 or 20,000 words.
Yes.
To make it into a sort of fuller-length novel. I think Patricia Cornwell published hers pretty much as was, without adding too much to it.
Yeah.
My British publisher wants to publish it next year and would like me to add maybe 10 or 15,000 words, so I'll probably have a think about doing that, and if I think it'll make it a better story, then I'll do it. Michael Cornwell Connolly was fantastic because, you know, I know Michael, I've got his email address, and so when the Times got in touch, I emailed him and said, A, do you think I should do this? And B, have you got any tips for me? And he sent me back this very long email saying, look, here are the pros and cons. This is what I found difficult when I did it. This is what I liked about doing it. And that was really helpful to me. Such a really nice guy and really helpful. Been really helpful to writers all during his career.
Yeah, Michael's a great guy. Great writer, too.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And what I like about that is it's kind of a throwback to a previous era of the days when Dickens would write, and when the ships pulled up in New York, they would bring the stories off the ship, and people would be lined up to get the next serialization.
Mm-hmm.
So I like that kind of throwback aspect to it as well.
I'll tell you what I like. I like the idea that people are going to want to read fiction in their Sunday paper.
Exactly.
I think that's fantastic.
Yeah,
you know?
I agree.
And if it, you know, it's the sort of thing that could bring new readers in, or could bring a new generation of readers in. Just this little Sunday morning thing. You can. It takes you 5 or 10 minutes to read it. So 5 or 10 minutes reading. You do that every week. You know, suddenly you're getting into books.
Exactly. I think it's a great idea, and I'm so glad that. That they selected you for that. Ian, what else has got your attention now? You're working on the next Rebus novel now. Any other projects that you're involved in?
Too many. Too many. After I finish the next Rebus, which I hopefully will have done by the end of May, I'm then writing a graphic novel, a comic book for DC Comics.
Wonderful.
In New York. They approached me about maybe as much as a year ago now, and they said, look, we believe you like comic books and have done since your childhood. Have you ever thought about trying to write one? And so we had an exchange of emails, and they said I could come up with a new character and a new story, or I could take one of the existing DC universe. And I chose John Constantine Hellblazer.
Wonderful.
And pitched an idea for a standalone graphic novel, and they went for it.
Oh, that's great.
I was in New York last week, and we had meetings, and everybody's very excited about it. So once I finish Rebus, I've got this new challenge of trying to write a comic book.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, well, I don't know. I mean, let's wait and see. Maybe I'll find I can't do it. Because it's not like writing a novel. It's more like sketching out a screenplay.
Yeah, but you know what? I mean, didn't you cut your teeth on comic books when you were a kid? I mean, that's how I learned
reading
to read.
Reading them, but writing them's a different thing.
Yeah. Anything, screenplays, TV?
Well, with a friend of mine who is a screenwriter and a scriptwriter, we did a film for the BBC, which we called Reichenbach Falls, which was about a novelist trying to get rid of his main character, who's a cop. and the cop doesn't want to die. That was good fun. Whether that will ever be shown here or not, I don't know. But we enjoyed doing that, so we're going to try and do something with my New York Times story, the Ocean's 11 one. We might try and turn that into a screenplay eventually. I've been doing some. I was approached by an opera company to do a libretto for an opera, so I'm having to think about that.
Oh, wonderful!
And I've been doing some lyrics for there's a project. There was an album that came out in the UK a couple of months ago called Ballads of the Book. And Ballads of the Book was a project where they got a dozen writers, novelists, poets, playwrights, and a dozen musicians, and they matched them up one with one and said, go away and write a song. So I wrote the lyrics for this guy called Aidan Muffet, and I gave him the lyrics, and he went off and he did the music and he sang it, and then it went on this album, and that was a lot of fun. And through that, another young Scottish rock band have approached me and said, would I write some lyrics for the next album?
Oh, great.
So I'm actually doing all the things I wanted to do when I was 11 years old. When I was 11 years old, I wanted to be a songwriter, and I wanted to write comic books.
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly at 46, I'm getting to do all of that.
There's that serendipity coming back to play again.
Yeah, it's just nice, you know, that you just because you're a success at writing one kind of story or one kind of book, suddenly all these other possibilities open up for you.
Yeah, well, you follow your passion, and the world opens up to you when you
because there's a lot of people out there follow their passion and nothing happens.
Exactly.
You know. So I'm so happy that all these things are happening for me.
Yeah. That is exciting. Well, Ian, I really appreciate your time today. In the naming of the dead, I was just I thoroughly enjoyed it. I strongly recommend it to the listeners. This has to be one that you're happy with now that it's put to bed.
It's the first book of mine, Casey, that I've ever, in preparation for a tour I was doing with it, I sat down and started reading it from page one to pick out a few passages to read out in bookstores and things, and I ended up reading the whole thing, and that's never happened to me before, because I was enjoying reading it.
Good.
And, you know, I enjoyed reading it so much that I read the whole thing. So, and I didn't see much that I would change, and again, that's also quite unusual. So you could say that I'm pretty happy with this book, yeah.
Good. Good. Well, best of luck with it, and then I'm delighted that about the serialization in the New York Times Magazine. And so, what we'll do is we'll catch up with you when the novel you're working on now, when the next Rebus comes out, and also I'm real interested in this comic book thing too. So I'll get in touch with your publicist, and we'll see if we can get some information about that album. Sounds like a real interesting project, too. We can maybe put that on the site as well. Do you have that on your website, some of that information?
It's entirely possible, but I'm very slow updating my website.
Okay.
The guy from my publisher in London, and he usually updates stuff. He remembers to put stuff in there because I don't. I'm very, very bad at new technology.
Well, I am too, but I've got people that know how to.
There might be stuff on the website, but I can't promise.
Yeah. Well, what we'll do is I'm bad at it, but I have some people that are good at it. So
that's what you need.
Yeah. So I'll make sure we get some of the things we talked about. I'll make sure those get posted on the website. And Ian, thanks again for writing a great novel, and I look forward to getting caught up with you again next year.
Yeah. Thanks, Casey. I look forward to talking to you about Rebus's retirement book.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Take care.
You take care.